Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, our first guest today says that if you replace most of your lawn with native plants, you will welcome the insects and birds that you're sure to attract. Danae Wolf, our guest, a wildlife photographer, educator, founder of the community conservation initiative called Chasing Bugs. And she's the author of a handy new guidebook. It's titled Grass Isn't Greener, the Everyday Conservationist Guide to Bringing Nature to Your Yard. Danae is with us to share some of the changes you can make to your lawn or garden that are going to make a big difference for the environment. So, do you want a wildlife-friendly habitat? Do you want to attract pollinators and get rid of invasive plants? Those are some of the things we'll talk about with her today in our part of her book. Danae Wolf, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Larry. I'm super excited to be here.
Well, before you're writing your book, you spent many years photographing insects in particular, and you created a community conservation initiative called Chasing Bugs. Tell us about that, just to begin.
Yeah, so I don't want to tell my whole life story, but it does start when I was pretty young. When I was about 12 years old, I got really interested in photography, specifically photographing sort of macro images of flowers and other plants. And hated insects, by the way, my entire childhood. Not just hated, but like really loathed. I hated bugs, spiders especially. I had really severe arachnophobia. And things kind of hit this point when I was actually around 20 years old. I was in college, still photographing plants, but my parents bought me my first macro lens and popped that onto my camera for the first time. And now all of a sudden I can be up close and personal photographing all those flowers that I had spent the last 10 years photographing. And I started to notice this whole new world. And that was this world of bugs that I had never really noticed before. At the same time, I was in college getting my undergraduate degree in environmental studies. So I was learning about ecology, local ecology in particular, and sort of the intersection of my interest in macro photography and then that degree in environmental studies just opened up this whole new world. And I was like, bugs are awesome. Like, what have I been missing out on my whole life? I used to think that nature was something that I would only find in these vast landscapes in the Amazon rainforest or, you know, the savannas of Africa, lions, tigers, like polar bears. And all of a sudden I'm like, oh my gosh, like look at these little alien creatures that have been underfoot this whole time. And that really sparked this interest in wanting to share their stories with other people to help other people kind of have that same interest. And then, you know, the last decade or more, we've been learning about the decline of insects. So it's not just kind of creating that baseline appreciation, but also there's kind of a sense of urgency, right? Like we know biodiversity is in decline and there are so many ways that we can help and we can start in our own backyards and our own gardens.
Pretty cool. And the photos, particularly the ones you have of insects in the book, are really, really cool. Did you, I'm assuming most of the photography or most of the photos in here are your own.
Yes, all but I think 10 or 12 photos of my are my own. My husband took a few of the aerial shots that you see of our landscape, yeah. But pretty much all the rest are my own. Yep.
So you talk about homegrown conservation. How do you define homegrown conservation?
Yeah. I think there's a number of different ways that we can define it, but I think at its core, it's really taking a more almost a more stewardship approach to our landscape as opposed to a management approach. I think culturally and historically, we've taken this very heavy-handed management approach. We call it landscape management for a reason. It kind of implies that we're bending the land to our will, where we want to do with the land what we as humans want, not what the natural inclination of the landscape is sort of destined to do. And as a result, we're pouring a lot of resources, particularly carbon-heavy resources, into that management. So homegrown conservation means taking a bit of a step back, taking a more stewardship approach, thinking of it as sort of like we're protectors, temporary protectors of this land for the time that we live here, And what we need to do is kind of realize all of the ecosystem connections that are happening or not happening as a result of how we could be managing the landscape. And we need to start restoring those ecosystem connections. We need to invite the wildlife back, put native plants back in our yards and in our community spaces. And that kind of creates the foundation for supporting wildlife.
And that probably inspired you to put this book together, I'm guessing.
It did. So I bought my first home about 15 years ago. And I remember thinking, you know, I want to do something, but I have no idea where to really get started. I think there's a lot of competing narratives out there too, especially in the landscape of social media. Things like, is no mow May actually good? Or is it really bad? And should we not be participating in it? So there's just a lot of competing narratives. And I like to say I wrote the book that I wish I had 15 years ago when I bought my first home. And I just needed like a handy sort of Kickstarter guide to understand the wealth of actions that I could be taking. Yes, native plants are foundational, but that tends to be where the narrative begins and ends. Like, hey, put the native plants back and you're doing a great job. That's true, but there's so much more that we can do as well. And the book really goes into some of those deeper things like addressing light pollution or thinking about being more water friendly, or even there's a whole chapter on community science programs, ways to get involved and start to kind of, you know, create stock of what wildlife are visiting your landscape, whether it's pollinators or whether it's, you know, the bloom time of different flowers. Scientists are using that information to inform how the climate is changing and how it's impacting different species all over the world. And we can help contribute to that data sets from our own backyards.
And I think your hope is that a lot of the fight against climate change comes from all of us sitting in our own communities.
Individual power and individual action is so needed. And I think that this is another area where a lot of people feel very disempowered. We think, well, I'm just one person. What can I possibly do? We need the government to take action. We need corporations to take action. Again, yes, 100% true. We need big action because we know that's where a lot of the harm to the environment is coming from. But we have a lot of power in and of ourselves, whether it's our power of the dollar and what we buy and how much we buy, whether it's the power of our vote, you know, what legislators we're putting into office and what policies they are or are not enacting in support of the planet. But it's also the own actions that we take. A lot of people think, well, it's just my landscape. It's just my yard. It's just some grass. What's the harm? But we have 40 million acres of turf grass here in the U.S. It is the largest irrigated crop here in the country. And 40% of that is in our home landscapes. It's in my backyard, the front yard, you know, our suburbs and urban areas. And we can shift that. We can change that. And we can make a real difference for the planet.
Well, and one of the things you write about is letting go of turf grass.
Yeah. Yeah. Letting go of grass is like step one, both from like an actionable standpoint, like we need to start moving our landscapes away from just being monocultures of weed-free, pest-free turf grass. But it's also a mind shift, right? Like we have to shift our way of thinking. We have to shift how we define beauty in these suburban landscapes. You know, having turf grass is a very cultural and societal thing. It represents this American dream. You have the big house, the big, highly manicured lawn. Again, very, very carbon intensive resource and water intensive resource to maintain. But there's beauty, I think, for a lot of that. And it's very much a societal thing. And it's reinforced by, you know, the train of landscapers that are parked along my street all day, every day, especially this time of year, as everybody's thinking about garden cleanup. It's reinforced by the train of door-to-door pest control salesmen that hover up on, now they use the hoverboards to get around the neighborhood. And they hover up and they're like, oh, we won't harm your pollinators, but we can get rid of everything else you don't want. And when I start probing and asking questions like, well, tell me what you do, Target by way of pest control. And they'll start to say things like, well, carpenter bees. And I'll tell them, you know, carpenter bees are actually really beneficial pollinators. So, you know, so much of it is just about kind of learning. It's about understanding what's at risk, beginning to appreciate that, and then kind of having that, feeling empowered with the actionable items that we can all partake in to just do better.
Jeff from the Birches and Bees Farm in Middlefield, Massachusetts, is listening in, a former Wisconsin resident, and he emailed to ask about pesticides or herbicides that you recommend for lawns, trees, and gardens. Are there nature-friendly products out there?
There's certainly a host of organic products that you can use, but actually I think the best approach is trying to foster a healthy balance in the ecosystem and in your landscape so that pest problems take care of themselves. You know, if you have aphids, for example, common garden pest, you know, rather than going out and immediately spraying pesticide or trying to treat it chemically, or even trying to like take a hose and spray them off, you can let it go for a few days and see if the lady beetles come and start taking care of the problem. I think too often we're very quick to want to take some sort of action and create a solution in the landscape without just taking a step back and recognizing that a healthy ecosystem has a healthy balance of predator-prey relationships. And that's ultimately what we're trying to do. Now, obviously, there's some pests that need to be controlled. Invasive species in particular sometimes need that. That may be chemical control or just a heavier lift, but it's really about learning and understanding and finding that balance.
You mentioned No Mow May earlier, which has got to be a kind of a big thing for many property owners. What do you think about that idea?
I have a lot of thoughts about No Mow May. I think it started in the UK as this initiative that basically said, you know, stop mowing your lawn in the month of May when the grass is really starting to grow. And a lot of our early emerging pollinators like bees are coming up from the landscape and they need floral resources to nectar and pollinate on. And unfortunately, in a lot of suburbs where we have these monocultures of turf grass, the bees don't find the floral resources that they need. The idea of No Mow May is if you let your lawn go, then you'll start to get some of those floral resources and it will provide a really healthy, is what a lot of people claim, you know, healthy resource of food. So this movement came to the U.S. a couple of years ago. It like just got blasted all over social media and it grew because it was like this super simple thing that you can do, right? Like what's better than or easier than just parking your mower for a month? Now we're starting to see the other side of that, some of the criticisms of the movement, things like, you know, most of what we're getting by way of floral resources are non-native dandelions and clover. Sometimes if you're lucky like me, you might have things like wild blue violet, which are often seen as a weedy species, but they are native and they're an important pollinator plant, especially this time of year. But there's some things to kind of break down, right? It's not as easy as like, oh, No Mow May is great or No Mow May is terrible. No Mow May can be a gateway for people who don't know where to start. And you don't have to go all in. You don't have to just stop mowing for an entire month. You can simply mow a little bit less frequently, or maybe just choose one patch of your landscape to not mow. That will help a host of different species, things like fireflies, which kind of thrive in those taller grassy areas. Having a little bit of taller grass is great. But if you just park your mower for a month, your grass is probably going to go pretty high, especially if it rains a lot. Like here in Ohio, we've gotten tons of rain. And I'm not going to lie, we had to mow. My husband mowed this past weekend. Our grass, like our dandelions, were almost 2 feet tall, some of them. So you're going to upset your neighbors, potentially. You might end up with a city fine, maybe. So it has to be a balance. Ideally, too, you know, turf grass, even dandelions and clover, it's not the best food source for bees. We want the native plants that bees co-evolved alongside. Now, in a landscape that has nothing but dandelions and clover, those can sort of be like fast food in what's otherwise a food desert. So that's kind of how I like to contextualize it. Ideally, you're gonna like rip out the turf grass and put in native plants, but if you're not there yet, then yeah, just mowing less frequently is a great start.
And mowing high. If you mow high, you should
mowing
be mowing.
High. Exactly, anyway. Mow high. That's another really, really great and easy tip to implement.
Danae Wolf, our guest today, her book is titled Grass Isn't Greener, The Everyday Conservationist Guide to Bringing Nature to Your Yard. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thank you. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Danae Wolf. Her new book is titled Grass Isn't Greener, The Everyday Conservationist Guide to Bringing Nature to Your Yard. Mary in Mountain, Wisconsin emailed, looking for some recommended trees for your yard that are great for wildlife, birds, and insects. Mary already has oaks, serviceberry, and black cherry in northern Oconee County with areas of full sun as well as shade, and she has sandy soil.
Yeah, so good question. Oaks are like the number one tree that you can plant for biodiversity. They support the highest diversity of Lepidopteran species, which are butterflies and moths. And you might be wondering, well, why do I want moths in my yard? Butterflies, of course, they're, you know, beautiful. Moths in particular, way more biodiverse than butterflies, by the way. And they provide a stellar food source for birds, particularly baby birds. So if you like birds, plant an oak tree. And sounds like you're doing the right thing with like the service berries and some of the other species that you recommended. It's a little bit tough to get really geographically specific and species specific here. So what I always recommend to people is plant for your ecoregion. The first chapter of the book is called Understand Your Land. And I cannot stress the importance of localizing the conversation, especially when you get to the question of, well, what do I plant? When you go to a big box retailer, for example, a big box nursery, you might find a ton of plants that are listed native. And they might be native here to the country. They might be native to the US, meaning they're not coming from another country, but they might not be native to your ecoregion. So we tend to use like the USDA plant hardiness zone map to dictate, you know, what to plant. That's going to help you understand like the survivability in terms of like cold hardiness, but it's not going to tell you which plants are going to support the highest biodiversity. So start by Googling what your ecoregion is, and then you can find incredible plant-specific, like ecoregion-specific plant guides from Pollinator Pathway, the Xerces Society, National Wildlife Federation, all fantastic resources that go through what flowers, what trees, what shrubs, what vines, what grasses are native to your region and will support biodiversity.
Christy in Chippewa County will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Christy.
Hi, thanks so much. I'm calling with a really strong testimony to what our speaker is presenting to us today. My yard is no mow, and it's quiet here with birds and fireflies, native plants, and my neighbors. I'm in an HOA wooded development where we can do what we wish. So I'm not watering, fertilizing, just loving this whole concept. The greatest challenge here, as with many areas, is the high density of whitetail. And so learning what deer will perhaps not browse as heavily, and then using quite a bit of fencing around native shrubs like nannyberry, dogwood, serviceberry, as well as some native trees. So excellent topic. And I like the realistic presentation of no mow May. I think there's a lot of validity there. Thank you. Learning so much today.
All right. Christy, thanks so much for calling. Comment, Danae?
I absolutely love to hear that. I love when people say like, yes, I'm doing this and look at the benefits that I'm seeing. And one thing mentioned there was the quiet. I can go out into my yard and I hear quiet. I hear bird song. That is something that I will share from my own personal experience is not something that a lot of us are privileged in hearing. We go outside this time of year and what do we hear? A cacophony of leaf blowing and lawn mowing and work being done. And I get it. Like sometimes, you know, that's needed. But when it is a constant sound of just mowing and blowing and just whirring and buzzing, it's difficult. And it does drain out the bird song and just the natural sounds of nature. But yeah, sometimes I hear you. You mentioned, you know, being in an HOA. These are all things that we need to consider. I was very deliberate in including a whole chapter about forging community unity and like how to get along with your neighbors if they're not quite there yet in their understanding of the importance of this kind of work.
Dora an email to ask, what do you do about anthills? There's a very large one that showed up in Doran's yard. And the question is, do they serve any good purpose?
Yeah. So I have two huge anthills in my yard too. We have let them be. We don't do anything with them, despite, as I mentioned earlier, this train of door-to-door salesmen trying to sell us on pest control. We had one time, and he was eyeing this anthill because he said, like, we can take care of the ants in your yard. And I was like, listen, the ants aren't causing us problem. They're food sources for, you know, a number of wildlife. But this idea of, like, are they doing anything good? This is a perception that I'm trying to change, because in the world of insects, we often ask that question. You know, I can go and give the most incredible story of, I'll talk about oak tree hoppers in particular, which are my favorite insect. They display maternal care. I've photographed like this maternal observation and care of an insect, which is kind of unusual in the world of bugs. And I can share this photo story with people, and immediately following, they ask, well, what good are oak tree hoppers to people? And it's kind of shifting that narrative of, do they have to be good for us to appreciate them and their place in the environment? They have intrinsic value. They play a role in the ecosystem. Lots of different ant species disperse seeds and help with planting, you know, different plant seeds. And ants just have fascinating sort of colonies, and the way that they've developed is not all that dissimilar from sort of human structures. And it's just fascinating. So what I would invite listeners to think about is, what intrinsic value does any species have? Even things that we tend to really not like ticks or like mosquitoes, they all play a role in the ecosystem, whether we like it or not. And, you know, if they're causing problems, if all of a sudden you have an anthill that, you know, kind of erupted near your foundation and now you're having ants come into your home, or you have a wasp nest, you know, in a very highly trafficked area of your home, like in the eaves above your front door, those are situations where you might need to ask yourself, okay, what do I need to do to manage this for my own safety? But oftentimes we can just let things be.
Well, I think you mentioned ticks. I think Wisconsin is the tick capital of the world. And I thought it was kind of fun. You had something about creating your own tick tubes if you...
Yeah. If ticks are an issue, and this is, when we talk about wildlife gardening, a lot of people start to question, like, are we going to invite ticks into our landscape, especially if we're leaving the leaves? You know, we talk about in the autumn, leave your leaves where they are, or let your grass grow a little bit taller. And a lot of people think, like, these are prime habitats for ticks. And actually, the research shows that prime habitat for ticks is these sort of margin areas between, like, a manicured, like, lawn, like turf grass, we head into, like, forest. So it's where we have, like, shrubbier, sort of weedy growth. So there are some ways that you can, you know, make sure that you're not creating that prime tick habitat. And one of those is through these sort of homemade tick tubes. You can buy them commercially too, but you can, you know, with some pesticides applied to, it could be cotton balls, you know, like organic, you know, safe cotton balls that you can have out in the landscape. You basically apply like a pyrethroid to it. And the idea is that mice that tend to be vectors of ticks in the landscape, they'll come and they'll use that cotton. You can even use like dryer lint, as long as it wasn't treated with like heavy chemicals or detergents. You can take that dryer lint, soak that in the pesticide, put it in this little like toilet paper or paper towel, like cardboard tube, and then place it on sort of the outskirts of your yard. The mice will come by and take those like little pieces of cotton back to their nest and basically help to kill the ticks from kind of their starting point before they can ever come out into your landscape. But there are other things that we can manage for too. We can create, you know, more solid barriers. So rather than having these like weedy overgrown barriers between maybe a manicured garden and more of like a forest habitat, you know, create a barrier of a couple feet of either mulch or gravel, and that will help detract and reduce that prime tick habitat in your landscape.
I'm thinking of the, I can't remember how many ticks per mile we have here in the state of Wisconsin, but it is indeed a large number. One of the things that I found interesting, and this goes back to soil, you have a couple of pages on what's your type, soil type, where you describe the various types, but then also give a way that you can figure it out with basically a mason jar and
yeah.
some water and a little ruler, which I had never seen that before.
And it's such an easy thing to do. Soil type is so important to the health of your plants. You know, we talk about putting native plants in our landscapes all day long, but what we don't often talk about is in many of our urban and suburban landscapes, the soil ecosystem has been heavily degraded. It's been modified, it's been tilled, it's been heavily compacted because we're walking on it or, you know, mowing over it with heavy lawnmowers all the time. So this, like, really regenerating soil health is, I mean, quite literally foundational to the health of the plants, which then will support wildlife. So there's a very, very easy soil. It's a soil type test that you can do. So it's not going to test for things like nutrient availability in your soil, but it will help you identify, you know, do you have a sandier soil? Do you have a more clay soil, which is might be a little bit harder to grow certain types of plants? You basically collect a soil sample, put it in a mason jar, fill it most of the way with water, shake it up very vigorously, and then let it sit for a couple of days. And those soil layers will start to settle out. And then you can literally just use a ruler, apply some basic calculations, and you can start to get sort of this percentage of what types of soil you have. And then that can inform, okay, if you have really sandy soil, you're not going to be holding on to water very readily. So the water is going to drain much more easily, which might impact what plants you choose. If you have very like clay soil, might be waterlogged, you know, it's going to be a wetter area. So you're going to grow plants that have those water loving roots.
I thought it was a pretty cool way to do it. I thought I might even try it just for fun in my own yard. Although I think I'm pretty well up on what the soil is. You do talk about testing the soil.
Yeah, I'm doing a soil test, and you can get a soil testing kit maybe from your local soil and water conservation district, your extension office. You can buy them again commercially, either online or locally. But understanding the availability of nutrients is really key here too. Not only your soil type, but are there some like modifications that you need to be making? Are there some, you know, amendments that you need to be making? And this will either inform or potentially even reduce like the amount of fertilization that you have to do. The less chemicals that we can put into the landscape, the better. We tend to be very fertilizer heavy, right? We think, oh, we need to even our lawns, we fertilize. And then it rains and those fertilizers run off into local waterways. And, you know, here in Ohio, just north of me is Lake Erie. And we get these horrible, harmful algal blooms every summer because of the excess nutrients like fertilizers that are running off into our waterways and ultimately Lake Erie. These harmful algal blooms are creating like dead zones, ecological dead zones in the waterways. They're making it really unsafe for people to recreate in the lake as well. So anything that we can do to inform how we can reduce those chemical inputs is going to be fantastic. So start with a soil test to determine what your soil landscape looks like and what you need to do to make it healthy.
Yeah. Thinking about Wisconsin here, most of our soils are very phosphorus rich. And so many areas have kind of laws against fertilizers for lawns, for example, that do not you want them without phosphorus.
Yeah, makes sense.
Because phosphorus is the element that really creates those blooms that
exactly that
you were talking about. Insects, let's, you know, you're really up on insects. And you certainly, as a gardener, a lot of times we think about only the pests, the insects that are kind of pests. And you did talk a little bit about how other insects can take care of the problems, like scale, for example. But the pest control methods you prefer are basically that, correct?
The pest control methods that I always prefer, yes, are creating basically that balance in the ecosystem where you have predators readily at hand. And when I say predators, we're talking about things like, you know, native praying mantids, we're talking about lacewings, we're talking about lady beetles, which I mentioned earlier. There's ambush bugs are one of my absolute favorite insects, although admittedly, I think I say that about every insect. But there's assassin bugs and ambush bugs. And I mean, crab spiders, jumping spiders, there's a host of different critters out there that feed on other insects all day long, right? That's just what they do, whether they're feeding on leaf hoppers, plant hoppers, you mentioned scale, little white flies, aphids, like there's stuff happening out there all the time. The diversity of parasitoid wasps in particular, this is something that I think is so under-researched and under-talked about in the world of gardening. I have heard that entomologists suggest that there could be a parasitoid for just about every species of insect out there. And we're talking about a million described species of insects, right? So there's probably a parasitoid that basically lays its eggs in or on a species of insect, and their young hatch, and then they feed on that insect and they take care of it, right? So there's so much value in creating that harmony and that balance before we immediately go out with a chemical control. Now, there are things that we can and should be doing, though, you know, just to kind of reduce that pest pressure. Again, it goes back to planting the right plants in the right place, making sure that, you know, it's not soil logged. Plants that are not healthy are going to be at increased risk. They're going to be more vulnerable to predation by those plant eating bugs. So healthy plants are going to just do better anyway. And most plants have evolved to withstand a certain threshold of feeding from whether it's caterpillars or anything else. So again, healthy plants need healthy soil. And then that will create this like balance of relationships in the landscape.
I was thinking about scale, because when you bring a plant into the house and it's got scale, there's nothing there to get, you know, to feed on it. I don't notice much scale outside in my landscape.
Yeah, I see it occasionally, but I also don't like, I'm not out looking for it, but we have a lot of aphid pressure here, even on those native plants like milkweed. You know, I have a lot of questions from people like, oh, we planted milkweed for the monarchs, but they're covered in aphids or other things, other native species. And a lot of people ask, well, how do we get rid of all of those things on these native plants that we planted for monarchs? This would be a good time to kind of remind folks that if you're planting something like milkweed for monarchs, milkweeds support a host of different insects too. So you might see milkweed beetles, milkweed bugs, and think, oh no, I don't want those on my milkweed because those aren't monarchs. Research actually shows that milkweed plants that have a higher diversity of arthropod species, of things like the milkweed bugs and milkweed beetles, actually increase the survivability of monarch caterpillars. And the idea there, the thought anyway, is that it's because you're kind of creating a buffet of options for a predator like a bird to come feed on. If it was just a monarch caterpillar, then the bird would eat the caterpillar. But now that the bird has a couple different options, it's going to increase that survivability and that chance of that caterpillar eventually making its way to a butterfly.
You're big on eliminating one thing, and that's invasives. Invasive plants. Talk about that. Some ornamental plants can become, have become invasive.
Yeah. In fact, many of our invasive plants were brought here as ornamentals. That said, not all ornamentals are bad. I think this conversation around wildlife gardening, sometimes people think it has to be all or nothing. It has to be all native or nothing at all. You can have a balance of non-native plants alongside native plants so long as they're not invasive. And many of the plants that we have in our landscapes are just that. They've turned invasive. We're talking, you know, a number of non-native honeysuckle species. We're talking things like privet and barberry. Bradford pear. I don't know how big Bradford pear is in Wisconsin. Here in Ohio,
you got a cool story. You got a cool story about, tell that story.
So Bradford pear, you know, this beautiful, although rather smelly, especially this time of year, ornamental plant that was basically bred to be a sterile variety of pear. And because of that, we planted them everywhere, like decades ago. We planted them as street trees all over the place, started to recognize that the branching structure of this particular species was kind of weak. And the branches would typically break off in ice storms or like wind storms, which obviously causes a risk if they're growing over sidewalks in suburban communities. So we started to breed some other varieties of pears that we could place in the landscape. We did that. And long story short, they co-bred with this other variety and created like this monster species that can now reproduce. It produces viable seed. And now we have this Bradford pear literally everywhere. It's in bloom this time of year. And it's interesting because if you don't know what you're looking at, it looks really beautiful. I mean, we're talking like acres along the sides of highways here in Ohio that you'll just see this like, you know, white blooming tree, and it looks pretty. And then when you tell people like, no, that's Bradford pear, it's a horrible plant, it's a stinky plant, and we don't want them, it starts to kind of reshape your perception a little bit. So plant identification, if you've just moved into a new home or you haven't been gardening for wildlife, going out and beginning to kind of identify what species you have growing, you might be surprised that some of your the plants that seem to not be invasive, because you might not see them popping up in your own landscape, you might be surprised to learn that they're very invasive. And what happens is, and this is sort of the key characteristic of what makes a plant truly invasive, is its ability to jump borders. So you might not be seeing that plant grow very aggressively in your cultivated landscape, but it's probably because you're mowing, you're manicuring your landscape. Birds could be coming by and eating the fruits and seeds of those plants and then dropping them in nearby forests or fields where they grow, and then they just take off and they begin to basically destroy and completely alter these native natural landscapes, like our favorite parks.
Jeff in Middlefield, Massachusetts, we go to you now. Hi, Jeff.
Hi there. Thanks for this great segment of your show. Ms. Wolf, like I have a farm, and you know, I can't wait to buy your book. Obviously, your advice and guidance isn't just for like suburbs and cities. It also applies to rural people, because you know, I bought a horse farm, and I'm trying to get rid of most of the grass we don't cut. I only use leopard frogs and garter snakes for fighting the insects. But I have two major problems. Anyone that's grown potatoes that's listening knows that if you don't put any chemicals on, which we don't, I have to pick off those potato beetles 3 times a day in order to keep the plants surviving. That's the first one. And the second one is knotweed. It's like a zombie. You cannot get rid of it. Japanese knotweed. Do you have any advice or recommendations on either or both of those? Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, great question. So potato beetles, I'm not a farmer myself, but I think that you're absolutely right that so many of the concepts in this book apply to all sorts of landscapes. We talk a lot about like the home, you know, the backyard, the suburb, the urban areas, but they really apply everywhere. We're talking about some more like philosophical approaches to our landscapes. I can't talk about the potato beetles in particular again, because I'm not a potato farmer. But what I will say is I think that agriculture has been blamed so much for the heavy use of pesticides. And we're like, oh, it's all the farms and it's not what I'm applying to my roses in my own backyard. We apply more pesticides per hectare or per acre to our home ornamental landscapes than farmers are applying to their farms. And farms are giving us food, you know, to feed a growing global population of people. Our yards are not doing that. They're, you know, they're providing something to look at. The ornamental plants that we're often treating are like pretty botanical statues in the landscape. So I would say, you know, we really need to reduce the pesticides use in our home landscapes, but farms are a completely different story. As far as the knotweed goes, we have knotweed here in Ohio as well. I used to work for the National Park Service. I was a park ranger, and we would actually host what we called knotweed stomps, where we would invite the public to come and literally like stomp it down, which was quite fun, actually. And then they would come in with chemical treatment and spray it. So this is another area when we're talking about invasive plants that tend to like, yeah, you can treat them manually. You can, you know, cut the stems of like honeysuckle, for example. Typically, you're going to have to come in and do like a spot treatment of like a glyphosate to soak down into those roots and to start to kill the plant. And probably not just one time, right? These plants are invasive because characteristically, they are very, very aggressive growers. So it's about treating the plants, but doing so in a way that you're doing it at the right time of day, not when it's going to drift all over the place onto non-target plants and other organisms. It's doing it the right time of year so that you're reducing harm to the environment and non-target species. And then it's doing so, again, not just like mass spraying, but it might be more targeted, a targeted application approach.
Jeff, thank you very much for calling. Talking today with Danae Wolf, who has written the book Grass Isn't Greener. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here as we talk with Danae Wolf. And by the way, Danae's first name is spelled D-A-N-A-E, which I think is pretty cool. And Wolf, like the animal with an E on the end of it.
Appreciate that.
And the title of the book, Grass Isn't Greener, The Everyday Conservationist Guide to Bringing Nature to Your Yard. John in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. John, hi.
Hi, Larry and Danae. Been really enjoying the program today. Something I've kind of been thinking about just as you talk, and I wanted to ask kind of your thoughts on. I live here in Madison. There's a relatively big push for like spreading wildflower seeds kind of randomly through the area. I mean, I bicycle a lot. I see a lot of people just with like a shaker on the front of their bike with native wildflower seeds. And I've always kind of wondered, you know, if you're shaking some seeds onto a spot on the ground, you know, how effective is this? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah. What do you think?
Yeah. I do have some thoughts on that. And I've actually seen this. This has been like a big trend on TikTok where people basically take like a pepper shaker, like one with like nice big holes that you can get, you know, flower seeds through. And what do they call it? It's like flower bombing, or you're just like literally.
Guerrilla gardening.
Yeah, that's it. That's exactly it. And I see people on skateboards or bikes and they just go along and shake things. A lot of those people have confirmed that they are using, you know, regionally local and native species, which I think obviously is a great start. I like to think of things as like a spectrum of good, better, and best. We want to put flowers back in the landscape, and anywhere that there's not flowers where there could be, like, fantastic. Let's get the floral resources back into the landscape to help particularly the pollinators. But if it's an area of land that you don't own, you don't steward, you don't manage, you don't know what's going to happen with it over time, you know, sometimes it takes more than just shaking some seeds on the ground to actually establish plants. Sometimes they do need to be watered. You know, there's this idea that if you plant native, you don't need to do anything. You just plant it and, you know, the plant will take care of itself. Oftentimes plants still need to be established and, you know, watered. They need to be planted in the right place. So if you're planting, you know, sun-loving plants in an area that is predominantly shady, they're not going to grow. Just this idea of like land ownership. Are you planting stuff on a plot of land, you know, where somebody doesn't want to plant something? So, well, I think it's great to like put plants back, and I think it's fun. I guess I have mixed thoughts about like the land ownership aspect of things, but the more we can do to put those flowers back into the landscape, the better.
John, thanks for calling. Robert in Amherst Junction, your turn. Hi, Robert.
Hi. I'm sorry to correct you guest on the air, but I think it's important that we are very careful about the kind of pesticides that we put into the environment. What she said about the tick tubes is a little bit wrong. I've been using them for years. They work great, but we don't want to put a whole bunch of pyrethroids in the environment, as they harm a lot of other beneficial insects. The correct substance is called permethrin.
Permethrin. You're right. You're exactly right. I really appreciate that correction.
Yeah. Robert, thanks for that correction. Yeah, he is exactly right.
Yep. It is permethrin. Yep.
Thank you, Robert. Appreciate that call. Well, boy, we're starting to run out of time, and there's so many things that we haven't, there are many chapters that we haven't dealt with here. One of the things about leaves, you mentioned leaving your leaves where they fall.
Yes. And this is a hard one for people because I think we've grown so accustomed to, it's autumn. Let's go out with a leaf blower and start blowing the leaves up and taking them away from the landscape. It's very hard, I think, for people to just let their leaves stay where they fall. because we have these neighborhood expectations, right? We want the turf grass. We don't want to suffocate the grass with the leaf layer. So that's important. But there are things that you can do. In my landscape, what we've done is actually create these like bordered, using landscape stones, borders under the canopy of the two great big pin oak trees in our front yard. And we will rake our leaves into those dedicated beds. And we're managing them like sort of the understory of a forest. So we're planting things like ferns, spice bush, and witch hazel, and we're really trying to steward them like a forest habitat. So there are ways that you can still keep the leaves in your landscape for the benefit of wildlife without having to, you know, go all in and just let them suffocate your grass and decompose very slowly over time.
Yeah, well, in a forest situation or a wooded situation, those leaves turn into fertilizer. I mean, it's just a circle of life kind of thing in a forest kind of setting. The other area I did want to bring up before we run out of time is lighting. You talk about lighting and you talk about power tools, and I'm kind of big on the lighting side of things too. So talk about your comments in your book.
Yeah, I have a whole chapter on the impacts of light pollution in the landscape, which is becoming a more well-researched topic in terms of how we can support or impact negatively wildlife. And light pollution, especially this time of year with like migratory birds coming back from their overwintering grounds in the south, they're coming back to their northern breeding grounds now, this time of year. Light pollution will draw birds into suburban and urban landscapes where they're at increased risk of bird strikes. That means flying into windows or typically because they see the reflection of what they think is sky or trees. And that creates mortality. Window strikes are one of the leading causes. Cats are also one of the leading causes, outdoor cats in particular, of bird mortality. But there are simple things that we can do, like shutting off any outdoor unnecessary lights overnight. If you have lights that need to stay on for safety, security, putting them on a motion sensor. If you have lights that just sort of blast, you know, light up into the atmosphere, creating that extra glare, that extra glow in the environment. If you can shade those, that's great. If you do have other lights that need to stay on, swapping bulbs to more of an amber color can actually reduce their the way that they attract like insects. They'll just less attractive to insects, which means you're drawing fewer birds in that are coming for those insects. So that's key. And Larry, too, you mentioned just this idea of like powering down and power tools, too. Going back to this idea of like carbon emissions, the way that we landscape traditionally tends to create this increased use of electricity. Even if you've switched over to electric tools as opposed to gas powered, they're still usually driven by a carbon based energy grid. And as a result, they're still creating these like indirect emissions. So anything that we can do to just reduce that power, not everybody is in a position to do that due to maybe mobility. It's not always easy to swap a leaf blower for a rake. So we need to be mindful of considerations like that, but there's so much that we can do, even planting the right plants to kind of create windbreaks and, you know, shade our homes during the summer and create those windbreaks, which help with, just keeping our house more insulated during the colder months. These are all things that we can do to benefit the planet.
And all included in your book and a whole lot more. Danae, it's been a pleasure talking with you today. Thank you so much for taking time. And your book's only been out a day or two. Well, I hope it does well. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Danae Wolf, her book, Grass Isn't Greener, the subtitle, The Everyday Conservationist Guide to Bringing Nature to Your Yard. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.